For persistent symptoms including fatigue, chronic pain, and cognitive decline, could chronic infection be an underlying cause? Chronic infections may be latent or occult, creating a prolonged pro-inflammatory state in the body that over time dysregulates the immune system and other body systems, sometimes leading to genome-wide changes.
People who become defensive around environmental exposures, like, that smells bad, I don't like that, or I don't like it. Those are people who are likely toxic. And it turns out for those of us who see chronically unwell people, it's the majority that are defensive around those odors and smells and fragrances and all that stuff.
On this episode of Pathways to Wellbeing, we welcome Dr. Tom Soule, longtime IFM educator and functional medicine expert, to explore chronic infection and how to manage them using functional medicine strategies. From the underlying mechanisms of chronic Lyme disease symptoms to the connection between Epstein-Barr virus and multiple sclerosis, Dr. Soult will highlight the important clinical connections between chronic infection and common persistent symptoms. Welcome to the show, Dr. Soult.
Well, thank you very much. It's really great to be here.
Well, I think I'd like to start this episode with a moment of gratitude for our immune system, because we owe our immune system so much. This is our body's defense against disease and infection. But as we know, sometimes the immune system can behave in ways that maybe we weren't expecting. So for those of us who have been removed from immunology class for some time, will you remind us about some of the red flags in your clinical workup that might suggest immune dysfunction or impairment or overactivity? How do we identify this in a human body?
So let's start with a simple question. Okay.
The easiest one, of course.
Yeah. Well, so chronic inflammation. Anytime you have chronic inflammation, you have immune system dysfunction because you are not getting to the resolution phase. Anytime you have persistent weird symptoms, right? So start at the top of the head, brain fog. Brain fog is either a mitochondrial issue, which is probably immune related, or it's immune related. If you have sinus issues that are recurrent or ear issues that are recurrent, or, you know, is your sense of smell or sense of taste or sense of touch off, that's probably an immune system issue. Do you have chronic respiratory issues? Do you have chronic gut issues? Really, you know, we think of the human body in silos, right? And the one system that's really hard to silo is the immune system, because it's very diffuse. So it is intimately involved in everything we do. I think the one that really sticks out the most, though, for most people is going to be some manifestation of chronic inflammation.
Right. I'm visualizing the functional medicine matrix and all these things that you've mentioned. Yeah. It's like a tour around the matrix. And I mean, for me, my clinician brain, that's part of the reason why immune dysfunction is so difficult to identify sometimes, is it looks like so many things, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yet it's probably the driver of so many of those things.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
You know, when I used to teach in the GI module, I said, unless there's a compelling reason to do otherwise, start in the gut. Well, why? One of the reasons why is because 70% of the immune system lives there, right? So we think about the gut and we think about digestion and absorption and elimination, but we don't often think about 70% of the immune system being right there.
Well, I was with a group of students this morning and we were reviewing the immune module and some of the lectures that you do in this module. And you talk about the fact that dysfunction of the mucosa in both the gut and the respiratory system is one of the major driving factors of immune system dysfunction. So again, looking at the matrix and seeing it come to life, there's this relationship between all of these different body systems.
And to take it back one step further, let's not forget the 30 micron biofilm on top of the mucosa. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, our microbiome, that is critical to barrier function integrity, that is part, really, in a sense, part of the innate immune system.
Right. Can we, I want to zone in a little bit on viruses for a moment. Sure. And this is a big topic, but when we think about the way that our immune system is behaving, is there a difference in the immune response from, let's say, a novel viral infection versus a latent virus that gets reactivated because of some trigger?
Sure there is. So with an acute viral infection that you're naive to, you're going to get the whole innate immune response that's going to then feed into the adaptive immune response, and that's going to result in a cellular response, but then also an IgM response, and then later towards resolution, an IgG response. And so that's where we get this notion that an acute infection means IgM, and if you had the infection but you don't currently have it, it's IgG. And that is a special case of just that naive response to an infection. In a reactivation, you already have memory cells. You already have all kinds of apparatus poised and ready to fight. And now you're going to get, you know, maybe just no IgM response at all, and you're going to get fluctuating IgG responses. Or sometimes, I like to say, sometimes people get a recurrent acute infection from an endogenous space. And the most obvious example of that might be cold sores or something, right? You have this herpetic virus in your mucosa or in your, really, your nerves, and it every once in a while blooms. And you might see the occasional blip of IgM, but mostly you're going to see a blip of IgG in those instances. So the immune response is completely different. And I think that's why we have so much confusion around these chronic recurrent viral infections, because, well, everybody has IgG. So what? Doesn't mean anything. Well, probably means something if it's 10 times the upper limit of normal.
Right. Yeah. You said in the beginning of the episode that really any of the signs and symptoms of chronic inflammation, we should probably be suspecting that there's something going on with the immune system. So when we look at whether it's an initial exposure or the reactivation of a virus, in terms of inflammation, do we see a big inflammatory response either way? And then we have to go digging and figure out, is this the first time we've seen this virus? Are we reactivating this?
Well, most of us are carrying most of the viruses in question since mid-teens, right? So whether it's Epstein-Barr, cytomegalovirus, or the herpetic viruses of, you know, 1 through 6 or 10 or 20 mm-hmm. or whatever it is, we are carrying those all the time. So most of the time, these viruses bloom because of some other perturbation within our immune system. Our immune system is otherwise occupied, and these opportunistic endogenous viruses say, oh, hey, good time to bloom. Let's make everything more complicated. Let's just bloom right now. And so if we're dealing with an adult population, the probability that this is their very first herpetic outbreak or their very first Epstein-Barr outbreak or whatever is remote, right? Because we've had them since our mid-teens. At least the vast majority of us have. And so most of the time it's a reactivation and it's a contributor to the overall inflammatory and immune dysregulation picture that we're having. Sometimes it blooms because it's just ornery, but most of the time these things bloom because our immune system is otherwise occupied. And that might be from chronic stress. It might be from a different infection. It might be, you know, from grief. There's many, many things that could cause our immune system to get distracted.
Yeah. Are those the same factors that make us, I would say, more susceptible to recurrent infections? It's the stress, mental, emotional, spiritual things coming up, changes to your diet. Like, what are the risk factors that you're seeing lead to either recurrent infection or prolonged infection in someone that they just, their healing time is taking so long.
Yeah. If you look at the matrix, the functional medicine matrix, right? Mm-hmm. A perturbation anywhere there. In fact, we used to call it the web way back in the old days. We called it the web. And I like to think of it in many ways like a spider web. And the beauty of that is as a spider with its eight legs can have its legs out on different branches of the web. And by the vibrations in the web, the spider knows exactly where the prey is caught. Well, in the same way, any perturbation, any disruption within any space in the matrix can have devastating consequences to the immune system. I mean, undertraining, overtraining, undernutrition, overnutrition, oversleep, undersleep, right? It's that basic, not to mention an outbreak of dysbiosis and leaky gut or, you know, whatever. So yeah, really anything. And I think the things that are deeply underappreciated, especially in our current, you know, North American culture, is we're all yang all the time, right? If we're not doing five things at once, then we're being lazy. So we have to just get off the stick and get going. And that all yang all the time is really a manifestation of fight or flight. And fight or flight is, you know, doing a whole bunch of things to us to conserve energy for the fight or the flight. And one of the things it's doing is turning off our immune responses to save energy for other processes.
Right. I imagine there's some overlap here, but I want to make a connection to when the immune system becomes overactive. So let's link this to autoimmunity. Are some of these same factors contributing to autoimmunity?
Well, autoimmunity is just a different way of being imbalanced, right? So you have those individuals who get sick all the time, and then you have those individuals with autoimmunity who seem to never ever get sick, except for their joints are being destroyed, or they're getting MS, or they're getting whatever other terrible thing there is. So it's all about balance. You know, it used to be we talked about TH1 and TH2, and then somebody said, well, but what about these regulatory cells? And then, what about this thing called TH17? And, you know, it turns out it's complicated, right? And this dance that we're continuously with, I like to say that there are sort of two parts to the immune system. One part is the one we all think about, which is the innate and the adaptive immune system and defense and repair and all that. But the part that we don't think about very much is the tolerance system. And that tolerance system is friend versus foe, right? And all those things, self versus other. And without that system, we're constantly fighting everything. You know, we're like it becomes friendly fire at some point. It becomes the immune system fighting everything, including our own tissues. And most dysregulations of the immune system are often a loss of tolerance more than they are any other thing. And that loss of tolerance results, I'm talking about autoimmunity. That loss of tolerance ends up in, inappropriate interactions between maybe the gut luminal content and your immune system. And that leads to molecular mimicry, and that leads to autoinflammation and autoimmunity and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, okay. We make a diagnosis of an autoimmune condition. We test some antibodies. Let's just use autoimmune thyroid disease as an example. We diagnose someone with an autoimmune disease. Is that our cue, if we haven't done so before, to go looking at what else is going on in your immune system? Are there some viruses I've missed? What's triggering the immune system? What does that workup and assessment look like?
Well, I mentioned earlier that much of autoimmunity starts in the gut, right? So much of autoimmunity, here's my famous little demonstration. My eyeballs are my immune system. My hands are the barrier of my gut. It should look like this. And, you know, you lucky people, you're all out in the lumen of my intestines. And so I can see you. You're human. I'm human. It's not really too concerning. But when I'm leaky, now I can really see you, and you are not me. And so my immune system is going to be inappropriately interacting with things in the lumen of my gut. And that's going to result in my seeing you and saying, oh, I better make antibodies against you. Well, you, unfortunately for you, you have spots on you that look a little bit like me. And so I accidentally make antibodies against myself. And that results in autoimmunity or autoinflammation or whatever it might be. And it's so that's a big piece of the puzzle is, you know, I like to say autoimmune disease is a master's class in, you know, well, Lyme disease, I say too, is a master's class in functional medicine. And you need to start and you need to keep going around the matrix, because every time I deal with the gut, it disturbs something else. And so I got to come back around, and now I've dealt with this and it disturbs the gut. So I got to keep going around, and we got to just start picking apart those areas of the matrix that we find. And again, unless you have a compelling reason to do otherwise, start in the gut. But we're also, you know, what's driving dysbiosis? Well, you know, at the turn of the last century, we had these miracle drugs for treating the scourge of society, like syphilis and things. They were called mercurials. Well, they were literally mercury salts and heavy metals and other industrial chemicals. Many of them have antibiotic properties, so they're actually driving dysbiosis. And then these environmental toxins have names like endocrine disruptor and, you know, carcinogen and obesogen and immune disruptor and so on. So another big driver of autoimmunity is going to be environmental toxins and detoxifying these environmental toxins, which is going to help with the dysbiosis. It's going to help with the leaky gut, and it's going to help the systems just work more efficiently.
Makes sense to me. Let me reverse engineer this for a moment. Yeah. Let's say we have someone, we get them on their 5R program for gut restoration. Do you see their immune-related symptoms get better with their gut healing program?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's not that simple, right? It's not, oh yeah, just do here. Here's 5R in a can and go home and take this powder and everything's going to be good. You know, it's the entire matrix that we have to deal with, right? So those people who have psychosocial stress, we need to manage that. People who have spiritual stress, we need to manage that. People who have SNPs that cause them to be in a pro-inflammatory state, we need to manage that. So it's the whole thing, right? It's far beyond just diet and lifestyle that is really imperative for autoimmunity. I mean, you can get a long way, but I like to say, you know, most people start the day with a neck, but many people end the day with no neck. And if you're the person who's, you know, like this all the time, well, when you're in fight or flight, you're inhibiting digestion and absorption. So even on a good diet, you're going to be functionally nutritionally impaired. You're shutting down parts of your immune system. So you're going to be functionally immune impaired. You're interfering with your frontal lobe. So judgment, and more importantly, delaying gratification and, you know, eating the thing that you should eat and not eating the thing you shouldn't eat is going to be impaired. So until we get some of those pieces of the puzzle, and this really comes from trauma, right? So we need to look at ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. We need to look at relationship traumas. We need to look at all of that stuff. But certainly a place to start. Yeah, absolutely. Let's start in the gut. And then let's talk about the autonomic nervous system, because it's a great place to sort of sneak into areas that are very difficult to talk about. It's hard to say, gee, how's your spiritual life? Because everybody's got a great spiritual life, including people who have, you know, Stockholm syndrome and are defending their captors, right? They're in this really abusive, codependent relationship, but they're defending that relationship. But if we, instead of asking about that, if we say, well, let's look at your autonomic balance, and we do a heart rate variability test, and it's showing that they're locked in fight or flight. Now it's an opportunity to talk about fight or flight and, you know, kind of like that sort of stuff. So there's nuance to how one has to manage the totality of the matrix, and getting to some of those difficult places requires rapport and requires sometimes sneaking in through back doors to talk about the result of that trauma rather than the trauma itself, because many times people are not ready or capable of dealing with the trauma quite yet.
Well, let me just recognize this is where I think functional medicine really shines. It's not intuitive, I think, for a lot of people to connect immune dysfunction to what's going on in the nervous system and your trauma and your loneliness and your lack of community. And the fact that you're tying these pieces together, like, this is really something special in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it is important and special. And I think it's not so much by the IFM community, but I think in the larger holistic medical community in general and holistic community in general, I think the psychosocial spiritual domains of health are not, they're squishy and they're difficult and they're hard conversations, right? So I think it's often things that are avoided more than they should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that same train of thought, you mentioned environmental exposures, and I think many of us are hesitant to go down that route because it's challenging. So will you just tell us from your experience in clinic, when someone presents with what looks like immune dysfunction or chronic inflammation, how do we know when it's appropriate to explore the environmental exposures? Are you doing this with everyone? Are you administering a questionnaire and that's raising your index of suspicion?
Yeah. So first of all, the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, they did a study. They looked at 10 babies, 10, you know, just 10 brand new babies, took their cord blood and investigated and found that they were able to find evidence for almost 300 industrial toxins in their cord blood. That's a small study, but nonetheless. So we're all toxic, right? We are all toxic. And I administer a little questionnaire, and it starts like this. Hey, how do you feel when you walk down the soap aisle at the grocery store? Just that simple. And some people say, oh, I love it. It's great. It smells so good. And some people go, like last week, a woman said, oh, man, when I was a teenager, it was great. And we had to have our perfume, and we had to reapply perfume in the middle of the day because there wasn't a big enough cloud around us. And now I cannot walk down that aisle, right? Or how does it feel when you're putting gas in your car? You know, how do those fumes that are coming back at you from the nozzle, what does that feel like? Or what's it feel like when you're standing on the street corner and the city bus goes by? You know, people who become defensive around environmental exposures, like, ooh, that smells bad. I don't like that. Or I don't like it. Those are people who are likely toxic. And it turns out for those of us who see chronically unwell people, it's the majority that are defensive around those odors and smells and fragrances and all that stuff. And then other questions in the questionnaire, like, you know, fatigue and brain fog and things like that. So I start with that. But I would say because toxins are so invisible, I do a lot of testing, not for me, but for the patient, because I know they're there. But I need them to understand that this is a serious problem. So I'll run a panel, and it's very common for my patients to be above the 95th percentile for 5 to 10 toxins and above the 75th percentile for another 10 to 15 toxins. So these toxins are really common and a big contributor.
Yeah. And then the treatment of those, you know, whatever your biotransformation and elimination support looks like, that becomes a really integral part of your treatment for their immune system, right?
Yeah. So think about it this way. If you're going to detoxify somebody, I would not go straight to, oh, let's detox you. We need to think about how do we eliminate toxins from their environment? And that's where, you know, clean eating, clean cleaning products, clean cosmetics, clean personal care products, all that stuff, lowering the toxic burden, and then optimizing excretion So kind of doing it almost backwards, right? Let's lower the environmental pressure. Then let's optimize excretion. So that's going to be a, you know, plenty of hydration, 5R program, you know, those kinds of things. And then we'll talk about optimizing phase one, phase two, phase three, you know, however many phases you want to talk about, detoxification. And now that we've got all that moving in the right direction, we can start to talk about mobilizing toxins. And so if you had water-soluble toxins, we'd want to drink a bunch of water to solubilize those water-soluble toxins and get them out of your body. But most of these toxins are fat-soluble. So we really need to be on a high fat, you know, high, clean, healthy, anti-inflammatory fat diet. And very frequently, you know, we might start gently with something like a Mediterranean diet or a paleo diet, and then move in the direction of maybe a plant-forward ketogenic diet once we feel that all the systems are running well enough to really start to mobilize these toxins. So often people want to go on a 10-day detox. Well, two problems. One, they're frequently too aggressive for sick people. And two, they're 355 days too short because we're being exposed to toxins every single day. So we really need to have an optimization of detoxification built into our lifestyle.
Yeah. When patients come to you and they suspect that there's something going on in their immune system or they feel like they're chronically ill, are they surprised when you say, now I want to know how you feel in the soap aisle? Now I want to know what's going on with your gut health. Are they surprised or they're expecting that from you at this point?
Well, it depends, right? So I have a tertiary care functional medicine practice, right? By the time they get to me, they already have a grocery bag full of stuff and they already have seen four or five practitioners. But every once in a while, I see somebody who's naive to the model and, you know, they're expecting a standard medical kind of approach, a pill for every ill. And you've got chronic inflammation. And well, gosh, how come you're not giving me steroids? Well, because I'm trying to get to the root cause, right? Steroids are a Band-Aid. Steroids are treating a symptom. And the root cause is, why do you have the inflammation in the first place? So is it diet related? Is it, you know, all the things we've talked about? So yeah, some people, it's a big non sequitur, absolutely. And the other issue with functional medicine is a lot of people think they understand holistic medicine and that's what functional medicine is. So it's sort of the same thing. But most disciplines, not all, but most disciplines of holistic medicine are really practicing green pharmacy, right? So you're depressed, but I'm not going to use Prozac because that's a drug. I'm going to use St. John's wort. Well, that's just green pharmacy. Functional medicine would really be, okay, you're depressed. Why are you depressed? Oh, well, you've got chronic upregulated inflammation. Oh, well, why do you have chronically upregulated inflammation? Oh, you've got a bunch of environmental toxins. Why do you have a bunch of environmental toxins? Oh, well, it's because you don't detoxify as efficiently as other people, either for genetic or epigenetic reasons. So, you know, it's just going down the hill to the more fundamental issues as we try to understand and then treat the underlying reasons.
I'm visualizing all these connecting points between different conditions that are across the matrix, like we've said. Will you help us to make a link between, let's say, chronic infection or immune dysregulation in some way and chronic fatigue syndrome, which I also find is somewhat challenging to, you know, pin down in a whole spectrum of symptoms someone might have?
So the idea here that I think about, the model that I use, instead of thinking about acute infection and chronic infection, I think about acute infection and then post-acute sequelae of infection. Mm-hmm. And this was really brought to the fore by, you know, COVID and long COVID, right? The fancy name for long COVID is post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2. But we've known about this phenomenon for decades. Right, we've known for decades that some people, a minority, and it always turns out to be around 10% of people who get COVID get long COVID. around 10% of people who get Giardia either get chronic fatigue syndrome or irritable bowel syndrome. And around 10% of people who get, you know, you name the disease, get some weird long form of it. And that includes Epstein-Barr and others. And so if we start thinking about a post-acute sequelae, now we're not talking about necessarily one thing anymore. We're not talking about, oh, you've got chronic Epstein-Barr, and therefore you've got, you know, something. We're talking about the possibility of a chronic infection. We're talking about the possibility of recurrent acute infection from an endogenous site. So your immune system walls off the infection and every once in a while it leaks out and gives you a new acute infection. But we're also talking about the possibility of other mechanisms that, you know, and many times these multiple mechanisms are working together. So you might have a component of a chronic and or a recurrent acute infection, but you might also have autoinflammation and immune dysregulation because of T cell exhaustion. And maybe the infection is completely cleared, or maybe you're having these recurrent episodic infections and your T cells are exhausted, or you have a loss of regulatory T cells, or you have, you know, all these different mechanisms for autoinflammation, or maybe you have trapped antigenic particles. So the infection is actually gone, but you've got LPSs trapped in tissue, or you've got, you know, in the case of long COVID, maybe you have spike protein caught in microclots that can't be broken down by the immune system, but they're still immunogenic in that envelope, and things like that. Or maybe you have these epigenetic reprogramming where there's histone or DNA methylation modifications, or there's silencing of T regulatory cells from epigenetic point of view, or maybe there's neuroinflammatory central nervous system dysregulation with vagus nerve dysfunction and microglia activation and all that kind of thing. Or, you know, mitochondria, bigger and bigger and bigger role that mitochondria are playing. Well, they're playing the role they always have, but our understanding, you know, mitochondria are not of just about ATP anymore. We know that there are anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial pathways within mitochondria. We know that they play a regulatory role. We know that there are extracellular mitochondria that play a regulatory role. There's all kinds of interesting stuff about mitochondria and how mitochondria interact with microRNAs and other regulatory aspects. And then just, you know, endothelial dysfunction and vascular dysfunction. So there's all of these non-infectious pathways that we need to start to think about when we're thinking about, gee whiz, this person really looks like they're infection. You know, like my practice is heavy with tick-borne illness, right? Because I live in the upper Midwest. So I see somebody with tick-borne illness, and of course, everybody says, well, I have chronic Lyme disease, and we need to get some really heavy-duty antibiotics. And we do every test we can think of, and we can't demonstrate any evidence of an infectious process. And it's really a delicate tightrope walk to try to help people to understand these other post-acute sequelae mechanisms and how they're just as devastating and just as awful as a chronic infection. But people are just really wedded to the idea that I have an infection, you know? Mm-hmm. But we have to broaden the net, because some people aren't infected anymore. Some people just have these other mechanisms. And most of the time they have some component of infection and some component of, say, T cell dysregulation, or some component of methylation dysregulation, or some component of toxicity. And so it's really this complicated ball of wax that we have to kind of sort out.
Well, with that in mind, I mean, my perception of all these mechanisms that you just described is that they're very complex and have the potential to be quite intimidating for someone who doesn't do this all day. So my question to you is, do we have to know the exact mechanism at play to deploy a treatment plan that will make someone feel better?
No. So I was at a lecture of Bob Rowntree's many, many years ago. Vashani, Arista Vashani was also talking. So Arista, who's this like mega brainiac guy, right? He's talking about all these mechanisms and mechanisms and mechanisms and mechanisms and mechanisms. And everybody's going like, oh my God, I'm going to die. I don't know if I know any of this stuff. And Bob, who also is a mega brainiac, as you know, he gets on and he goes, wow, just like Bob would, right? Wow. And he says, that was really interesting, wasn't it? And it seems really complicated, doesn't it? But it's not that complicated to treat. Take some fish oil.
Yeah.
Take some curcumin. Take some, you know, quercetin. Get on a lifestyle. Get on a diet. And you know, it all boils down to the five modifiable lifestyle factors fundamentally. Fundamentally, it all boils down to the five modifiable lifestyle factors. You know, and throw in, I like to say that functional medicine is the five modifiable lifestyle factors and applying those five modifiable lifestyle factors to the matrix, right? So we're going to modify the modifiable lifestyle factors to fit their particular matrix. And then supplements are accelerants. Supplements are just there to move things along a little faster, to just gently push physiology in the right direction. So, you know, somebody comes to you with long COVID. And you can read all the papers and you can think, you know, you can hear, oh, well, some group is really interested in ivermectin and some group is really interested in, you know, name the other weird HIV drug, or they're interested in colchicine, or they're interested in that. Or you can say, how's your diet? Really, you're on the standard American diet. Well, did you know that if we take that line of grains at the bottom, 7 to 11 servings of grains, and we fold that up into fruits and vegetables, we can 2.5 times the nutritional density of your diet? So if all we do is put them on a paleo diet, we've 2.5 times their nutritional density. And, oh, you're all stressed out, huh? And you never sleep. Oh, you think you can get by on 4 or 5 hours of sleep every night? I wonder if that's having an impact. And when you fix all of that stuff, which is simple, but not easy, right? These are simple interventions, but not easy. You know, talk about their autonomic nervous system. Well, they're wired up tighter than a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs, right? So they're really twitchy, and manage that. What's that going to do? So if you do all those things and you have programs in your practice to really manage them and help them and coach them and support them, these people get better. But the bottom line is we're sitting knee to knee with human beings, and we need to connect with those human beings, and we need to deliver what they need, you know? So if they need help with their autonomic nervous system, we need to help them with their autonomic nervous system. And we need to be unafraid to enter in that realm. And if they need help with their diet, interesting. So I think it's an interesting story. I had a woman in my practice many years ago, and it turns out she had celiac disease. But I didn't know it at the time. I just knew her guts were goofed up and she had all kinds of problems. So I asked her to go on an elimination diet, which happens to be a gluten-free diet. And she comes back in a few weeks and she says, yeah, I didn't get to it. You didn't get to the diet. Okay, well, what happened? Well, I'm just busy, you know. So, okay, fine. Well, let's try it again. So she comes back and she goes, yeah, I didn't really get to it. All right. Well, so strike one, strike two. We're not going for strike three. What's going on? So that enters us into a series of conversations where we discover together that her mother, well, I discovered, she knew, her mother died when she was 13. And her mother's approach to unwellness was to give her daughter milk toast. Mm-hmm. And milk toast to her when she is ill is her mother, right? And so how is she going to give up milk toast? So we're having these conversations and she has this revelation. She literally said this: my mom doesn't care about milk toast. She cares about me being well.
Wow.
And bang, now she's like the most compliant person in the universe at doing an elimination diet. And she gets completely better. And then we go on to figure out that it's celiac disease. But these are the things that happen to people. They are so attached to something because of a trauma or because of some other reason in their life that they just can't do it. So I like to say the magic isn't in my, you know, omniscient wisdom. The magic is when a patient doesn't comply. The magic is when they don't do something you ask to do and you explore it. And when you explore it, that's when you find the real humanity and the uniqueness in this particular case.
The therapeutic partnership. What a compelling reason to ask those questions that maybe no one has asked before.
Yeah. Because that's where the magic is.
Right. Yes. Well, while I have you with me, you mentioned in your practice, you see a lot of tick-borne illness, and I cannot let our time go by without asking you about this because you teach about this topic in the Immune APM. And we know that this diagnosis remains somewhat controversial, and I'm hoping that you'll take somewhat, right?
Yeah.
I'm hoping you'll take a few minutes and talk to us about why this diagnosis is so controversial and how functional medicine approaches it differently, which I think is what we've just been talking about.
I think it is too. So why is it controversial? Because often there is no evidence of infection, right? So the Western blot is negative. The fancy specialty lab test is negative. And yet these people feel terrible, right? And they've been marginalized by the medical community. They've been told that it's just in their head, or they've been told they're malingerers, or they've been told they have secondary gain. There's this beautiful scene in the documentary Under Our Skin. And there's a woman, and she's talking to the interviewer, and she says, you know, I was feeling so awful, and I asked my boyfriend, how do I look? And my boyfriend said, you look so beautiful. And she said, you can't believe how much pain I'm in right now. And then she recounts a talk that she had with her doctor. And her doctor said, well, you know, we can't find anything wrong with you. And frankly, we're thinking maybe you just don't like your job. And then she reveals, I'm the special events planner for the band U2. I love my job, right? So this notion, we make these assumptions about people. So I'm not smart enough to figure it out. Therefore, it's in your head. No. That's not the way it works. It's we need to come with trust and belief to our therapeutic encounter. You know, and people sometimes say things that from a physiological point of view, we just think, well, that can't happen. Well, so what? It's their experience. Now, they may be interpreting things in ways that are physiologically impossible, but that's just their interpretation. What we need to do is come to the therapeutic relationship with trust and belief. And what I know for sure is you told me you feel terrible. That's the only important fact. All the other details they told me about this, that, and, you know, and a ghost came and whatever else happened. Okay, well, that's your experience. But we need to do the things that we can do based on their experience and what it means to them. Because meaning is more important than physiology. There are plenty of studies that show this. In fact, just recently, I saw, and of course, I'm not going to be able to give you the citation, but the issue was these diabetics are given a food, and one group has said, listen, this food is really good for diabetics. You should eat a lot of it. The other group, they're told, listen, this food, it's kind of not very good for diabetics. Be careful with it. But they're all asked to eat the same amount, and they do. And the group that was told that it wouldn't be bad for their diabetes, their hemoglobin A1C and blood sugar stayed the same. The ones that were told this is going to be bad for you, their blood sugar spiked and went through the roof. And their science is replete with these kinds of studies. And yet we walk around thinking that physiology is the paramount thing, but belief is the paramount thing. And if we don't address their beliefs, I believe I'm sick and I'm never going to get better. Or, you know, here's my pill. Oh, I hate these pills. I don't want to take these pills. Versus, thank you, God, for the opportunity for these pills. Or as I, you know, here's my milkshake. oh, it tastes terrible. Well, it's not a milkshake. It's medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So let's think about this in a way that's, you know, altering and framing their beliefs to make their beliefs a powerful ally in healing.
Right. Yeah. So it's acknowledgement of their lived experience and then the willingness to tour the matrix, as we've been talking about, to engage in that mental, emotional, spiritual aspect of their health, to work on the things maybe other people aren't thinking of, their mitochondrial health, their toxic exposures, but really the root of it being the acknowledgement, I hear you and I believe you and I'm willing to remain curious with you.
That is the most important thing I do every day is listen and hear. You know, storytelling is a therapeutic intervention in every culture on earth. And giving the patient the opportunity to tell their story to an engaged listener, that all by itself, for many patients, is the single biggest therapeutic intervention that they have ever had. Just think about that. Sitting, listening, and being engaged. And you don't think, well, that's ridiculous because I use drugs, I use medicine, I use surgery. Okay, well, you know what? The truth is that most of the things doctors do every day are not supported by science. I mean, you know, look at the Cochrane Library anytime you want. Half of the stuff we do is no better and in some places worse than placebo. So let's retreat to the things that are deeply human, like listening. And then, you know, I'm not saying don't use supplements or drugs or medications or surgery if necessary, but this is the art of functional medicine, is getting into the center of that matrix and holding that space for people.
Beautifully said. Like you mentioned, it's really, this is the art of doing medicine. And you may have already revealed your answer to this question, but as we come to the close of this episode, I want to hear from your perspective. What do you hope clinicians and patients will take away from the conversation we've had today?
The single most important thing you can do for your patients is hold space for them. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a loaded term of the, you know, I'll say rehab space maybe. But holding space simply means creating a safe environment for people to tell their story and then be an engaged listener. Because as Osler told us, listen to your patient. They will tell you what's wrong, right? So listening. They tell us what's wrong. They make our job easy. They tell us what's wrong. And then we fit their story, their interpretation of their lived experience. We fit that into the matrix. And then we realize, oh, they have dysbiosis and they have immune dysregulation. They have upregulated inflammation and they have hormonal stuff and they have toxins and they have this, that, and the other thing. And then we just start picking away at it. And as Sid Baker liked to say, functional medicine is like tailoring a suit. You don't get it right the first time. You have to try it on a few times and make little adjustments. And so never think that functional medicine is one and done. I have patients that I've been seeing for years and years, and they're making progress. But sometimes it's slower progress than either one of us would like. The normal cases are people working hard and being human and falling off the wagon and having to crawl back on and working through the problems day in, day out. And so our job is to walk the walk or run the run, but be in it for the long haul for these patients who are struggling so deeply.
What a lovely way to close this episode. Dr. Solt, thank you so much for your time and your clinical insights and all of these pearls you've shared with us today. It's just a pleasure to chat with you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was really fun.
To join the conversation on this topic, visit IFM's pages on Facebook and Instagram. For more information about functional medicine, visit ifm.org. The future is functional.